They were both deep into new music. At one point, Dad spotted a CD in the pocket of Professor Mark's open car door, and he said, "Mark, is that the new Taylor Swift album?" Professor Mark raised his palms. "I can't help it," he said. "I like it." But the son came to Professor Mark's defense. "Don't apologize," he said. "That's a good album, Dad. But Professor Mark, have you gotten the new Tyler the Creator yet?" And Professor Mark struggled to remember what his best friend's son was talking about. "No," he said. And then Dad said, "Oh, it's really good, Mark. But son, I have to say, I like the new Earl sweatshirt a little bit better." And that was the way they were for the rest of the night, constantly talking about the bands they liked, going down increasingly obscure musical rabbit holes. It was humiliating. And I had recently been doing a huge amount of internet work, finding new songs that children like so that I can remain young, vital, and relevant. But these two were just lapping me, trading trivia about bands with names like Deerloaf and Starfart and No Monster Club and Mark with a C, and Nescafe Moments, and Couchebag, and Loath, and I'd never heard of any of those bands, even though I made up all but one of them. When we went to the old State House, I did my job. I chatted with young faculty members, a few of whom knew who I was and wanted pictures. I chatted with older folks who did not know at all who I was until I said, "And I'm a PC." And then we did pictures again. This sounds like maybe I hate these things, but I love them. I am grateful for the attention. I love having words to say when older moms and dads ask me what I do, and I love hearing about their retirements and hobbies. Even as a grown-up, I love pretending to be a grown-up. And plus, the reconstruction of the old State House was truly beautiful, with the big paneled doors open to the brick archways that framed the lawn and the river and the twilighting sky. And also, they were serving pigs in blankets. But it turns out Dad and son were too cool for an old State House party. I didn't see them anywhere. And after a while, Professor Mark caught me to say it was time to start heading over to the Samuel Clemens address, but he was worried. He couldn't find them anywhere. So I surrendered my plastic flute of kava to a side table, and Professor Mark and I went on a best friend hunt. We found them upstairs, in a low, long-paneled, fake State House chamber, leaning out the window, smoking parliaments, drinking Amstels, talking about Diplo or some garbage. Ugh. Daddy Pitchfork and Pitchfork Jr. Professor Mark said some words like, "Come on, you guys." Annoyance, clothed sheepishly in sadness and utter unsurprise. I saw something now, something that maybe Professor Mark didn't even see, a story under the surface. And also a gambit. Professor Mark was losing his best friend. Daddy Pitchfork had a new pal. Daddy Pitchfork was buying bourbon to drink with Pitchfork Jr. now, not Professor Mark. And perhaps an unconscious answer, Professor Mark bought a different bottle of bourbon to drink with me, a stranger, and a new buddy. "I thought I came here to deliver a Samuel Clemens address," I wanted to say, "not be a wedge in some dude's best friend love triangle." But I did not say that. Professor Mark, if you're listening to this, maybe I'm wrong in my psychological assessment of this situation. But probably not. I am very insightful. Pitchfork's Pear and Feast apologized. They dropped their cigarette butts into their Amstel bottles, and we walked over to the college gym. And there I gave the Samuel Clemens address, and you know what? It went fine. I just did my imitation of stand-up comedy, including a long bit of incredible improv surrounding the design of the state flag that hung from the gym ceiling. I'm good at flag work. True, the professor did trick me into whitewashing a fence about halfway through, but do you know what? Even that was fun, just like he promised. That is a reference to Tom Sawyer, of course. I just put that in there to show you that I do know at least one other thing about the works of Mark Twain. There was no real fence, but the metaphor stands. After the lecture, Professor Mark introduced a bluegrass trio he had invited to play. Again, nothing to do with Mark Twain, Professor Mark was just curating an enjoyable gym jamboree for his students and himself, an impulse I would applaud even if it hadn't been a great success. And it was. The band was two men and a woman, I seem to recall, all young and glowing and tattooed, playing old-timey songs, and Professor Mark said to me, "You sing a little, right? Why don't you sing along with us to the next one?" No thank you, I said. But I did stand on stage and listened to the song. The song was called Rocky Top. Rocky Top is not a song of the South, nor the North of the South, nor even of Professor Mark's Southwest. It's a song of the hills of Appalachia. It's one of the seemingly 35 state songs of Tennessee. The Tennessee Volunteers use it as a football fight song because it is fast and fun and tells a story of a remote paradise in the hill country. According to the lyrics, Rocky Top is a place without smog or smoke or telephone bills, the three known conditions of utopia. "Once two strangers went up Rocky Top looking for a moonshine still," goes the tune, "but the strangers never came back." It is fairly clear from the context that they were murdered. It's a great song. But while Rocky Top is very upbeat, at the end I heard Professor Mark singing, and I appreciated how sad a song it is. It's really a song of lament for a lost place, a lost life. Even the song knows that the wish expressed in the very first line, "Wish that I were back on Rocky Top," will never come true. The last verse of the song is especially sad, and I listened to Professor Mark sing it. He sang, "I've had years of cramped up city life, trapped like a duck in a pen." Now, this is a terrible lyric. It's terrible. First of all, cramped up sounds gross. And trapped like a duck? That's weird, right? I admit that I'm a city boy myself, but you don't trap ducks, do you? You shoot them, right? I mean, maybe if you're banding ducks for scientific population studies, you would trap them first and then release them, but somehow I don't think that's what a Tennessean dreaming of returning to idyllic mountain and moonshine life would be singing about. The point is, the metaphor raises more questions than it puts to bed. See? Puts to bed. That's a good metaphor. You know exactly what it means, and I should know. I studied literary theory at Yale. And with that line, I am grateful that Felice and Budlow Bryant, who wrote the song, and the Osborne brothers, who made it their signature song, are not here right now to kick my teeth in. But I had to give you that first terrible part of the lyric, because it leads to the transcendent final line. "All I know is it's a pity. Life can't be simple again." I cannot fault the poetry of this line. It hit me hard and deep as I heard it in the gym. The song's message is no longer, "I wish life could be simple again." It's not even, "I know life cannot be simple again." It's that all I know is that life cannot be simple again. It's a consuming knowledge, an overwhelming sadness for what is lost that makes enjoyment of the present impossible. Now, normally, I consider nostalgia to be a toxic impulse. It is the twinned, yearning delusion that A, the past was better, it wasn't, and B, it can be recaptured, it can't. It's this nostalgia that leads at best to bad art, movie versions of old TV shows, and sad dads watching Fox News. At worst, it leads to revisionist, extremist politics, fundamentalist terrorism, and the victory, in Appalachia in particular, of a narcissist Manhattan cartoon, maybe millionaire, and cramped-up city creep who, if he ever did go up to Rocky Top in real life, would definitely never come down again. But when I heard Professor Mark sing this line, I did not feel those things. I felt something else. I felt a kinship. I felt a sudden sense of friendship on the one hand, and bestness on the other. Friendship and bestness, two distinct concepts that I am not connecting in any way, but I felt them both. After the singing, at the end of the night, Professor Mark quietly offered me thanks. And what's more, he offered me reprieve. He He said, "John, I know we worked you pretty hard today, and thank you. I know there was some talk about a party after, but please don't worry about that. You should just go on back to the guest house by yourself if you like and get some rest." And I thought of him, driving home alone in his suit, with his day clothes stuffed in the back of his Saturn. And I said, "No. Let's go. We are totally going back to that little house, and we are going to party. Get that kid and his dad and everyone else you can find." And so we went back across the lawns in the warm darkness, and we turned on all the lights at the guest house. We had Daddy Pitchfork with us and Pitchfork Jr., plus some other younger faculty members and one guy wearing a vintage tuxedo jacket and chunky glasses. These people are in every state of the union now. And we did it. We forced a party. Around the living room, we had Professor Mark in the wing chair talking to a member of his department. Chunky Glasses was next to me on the couch talking to a young woman from the psychology department. And then over by the small table, by the back screen door, Daddy Pitchfork broke out his bottle of bourbon. And in a perfect southern ritual, poured one for his son first, and then for himself, and then passed it around. To his credit, Daddy Pitchfork also provided a huge bag of Chex Mix, which is a really gracious thing to do. Where I live in Park Slope, we're not allowed to have such things. I dug around in the Chex Mix for the pumpernickel rounds. Oh, you put them into your mouth and they just begin to burn into your tongue, as they are steeped in Worcestershire sauce plus all the salt in the sea for 1,000 years. I was beginning to like these guys. I listened for a while as Dad and Son traded facts about Frank Ocean, and since I had taken bourbon and Chex Mix communion with them, I thought I would try to make friends. "What do you two think about Macklemore?" I asked. Okay, please note that this happened a few years ago. I had heard Sir Mix-a-Lot discussing Macklemore on a Seattle public radio show during the previous spring, and then I looked up Thrift Shop on YouTube 9 months later, so I was feeling pretty up to date. "What about that cool song," I said, "called Thrift Shop?" Daddy Pitchfork quickly averted his eyes, ashamed for me. But Junior seemed legitimately confused. "Wait," he said, "isn't that song from last year?" And I said, "Probably, yes, I don't know. Look, I am in my 40s now. I do not know who I am or what I am supposed to be anymore, and I do not know when songs came out, but I do know," I did not say, "that I do not like you." At that point, Chunky Glasses suggested maybe we should have some music. And should he get his speaker from his car? And I said, absolutely yes, because I was going to show them. And he came back with a ridiculously huge powered amp that I could hook my phone into. And so I began to play my cool songs, Parquet Courts, Cloud Nothings, Destroyer. The party started to come to life. To be clear, nobody danced. We were all white. And these were all songs purposefully written for white people to not dance to. They were designed for brow knitting and almost imperceptible head nodding and trivia contests. And to my immense pleasure, that is what was happening. Pitchfork Jr. elbowed his father. "Hear this, Dad? This is Purity Ring. I was just telling you about them. The producer and the singer live in different provinces of Canada and never saw each other when they were making this album." Daddy Pitchfork cocked his head and let some Canadian electronica throb into his ears and then nodded. "How about that?" he said. "They're pretty good." And I wanted to say, "Yes, they are good. And I am the one who knows this. I know this. Because unlike your son, I saw them in Williamsburg, Brooklyn last year. Because I know the guy who had just signed them. The guy who used to be the drummer in a band called the Long Winters, but he grew up and got a day job and now runs a whole record label. I know him because I met the lead singer of the Long Winters at a benefit concert for Dave Eggers' nonprofit. It was the same benefit where I met David Byrne and St. Vincent before they met each other. Yeah, so I'm dialed in. I've made dinner for Black Francis from the Pixies and his family at the house that I own. Because we have kids the same age." But I didn't need to say any of this, because now they knew. And if you didn't know, now you know. No one has more cred than John Hodgman of Brookline, Massachusetts. So I just went on and played even more incredibly cool rap and indie rock songs that I had heard about from NPR and McSweeney's. Gene Gray, A.C. Newman, Toon Yards, The Mountain Goats, Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down. People continued to not dance. It was a good party. But then, I don't remember who it was that said it. Probably Chunky Glasses or Pitchfork Jr., but somebody said, "I just don't think Elvis Costello is very good." Now, this will make many people angry, but I do not care about Elvis Costello. As with Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen, I was born without a certain genetic pure enjoyment receptor for Elvis Costello. I got the Tom Waits RNA instead. Many would have me murdered for this lack of taste, but it's just a difference of brain chemistry, and it is my disorder to bear. That said, I appreciate all those artists. I know they are great artists. I know that Elvis Costello is a brilliant songwriter and lyricist. I know that he is not merely good, but in fact, very good. And to say otherwise is not tolerable. Not at my guest house best friend party. So, I went back to my phone, and I swiped through my library, looking for that one Elvis Costello song that I like to listen to. It was Oliver's Army, and I played it loud. And I noticed then that Daddy Pitchfork stopped talking to his son. He looked up into some middle space and smiled. I did not notice then that Professor Mark did the exact same thing at the exact same time. I don't think Daddy Pitchfork noticed this either. But at the exact same time, they then stood up, and they saw each other, and they walked to my corner of the room, where I stood with my phone and my one Elvis Costello song. They knew this song. And they put their arms around each other, and they sang this song, "Knowing the Words by Heart, by Friendship." To my eye, it was clear. Daddy Pitchfork wanted to be a friend to his son, who was growing so quick, and also he didn't want to get old and die. But when it came down to it, he was a grown man, and this grown man didn't want to be thinking about Purity Ring or memorizing the discography of Tame Impala. Part of him just wanted to be back on Rocky Top, singing the old songs with his old friend. And now they were doing it. And I made it happen. I got the best friends back together again. And that's when I turned to Pitchfork Jr. preparing to say, "Check it out, son. I stole your dad." But Pitchfork Jr. was gone. Somewhere in the middle of Oliver's Army, he had gone outside. Probably to smoke marijuana. Maybe with the young woman from psychology. I don't know. Definitely without me. I never did end up having any marijuana that night. However, I did succeed at blacking out. I drank many bourbons of both the Professor Mark and Daddy Pitchfork vintages, and then I woke up, and it was morning, and I didn't know where I was. I just shot up in bed, on top of the bedspread, and what I did not remember was my bedroom at the guest house. It was early morning, the window was open, and the sheer curtains floated on the cool spring breeze. For a long time, in the universe, there was only that window and the scene it framed. A ribbon of bright blue sky, shimmering above a ribbon of bright green forest. That ribbon of spring trees floating above a ribbon of bright blue river, and the river finally lapping up to a ribbon of bright green lawn. That combination of colors was all there was in the world and all there was of me. Gradually, I came back to myself. I slowly recalled the night before and the dissolution of the party and my goodbyes and my trudge upstairs, and then I remembered other things like my job and my name and the names of my wife and children. But that morning light in the window was so vivid and otherworldly that I wondered if everything I remembered was in fact a dream. It seemed possible then that nothing I thought I remembered was true, and when I stepped out of this bedroom door, I would actually find a different life waiting for me, Maybe this was my own house and not the guest house. Maybe I would be younger or older. Maybe downstairs I would not find my wife and children, but a different family. Maybe I would no longer be an only child. Maybe I had a brother, and maybe we were going to a wedding. And who knows, I thought. Maybe this is what happens every morning. Maybe we wake to a new life every day and grasp sadly at disappearing memories of the last one as we awaken until they are finally burned off by the sun. Obviously, I'm not the first to express these ideas, but I include them here for my children. I want to show them. I want to show you, children. You don't have to smoke marijuana to get deep. You don't have to smoke marijuana to have sophomoric thoughts about the universe. Stay off the drugs, kids. And of course, I was still me. My memories were real. Everything that happened that night had actually happened. I knew this for two reasons. One, I was still wearing my sweaty corduroy three-piece. I had slept in it. And two, as I stood and smoothed myself for the journey home back to my real family, who had not disappeared, I am lucky to say, I found something in my jacket pocket. It was something that had not been there before. It was a mixtape burned to a CD-ROM. Remember, this was the ancient past. There were two words written in orange Sharpie on it. Frank Ocean. And then there was a yellow post-it saying, John, check this out. Hope you like it. It was signed with the real first names of Daddy Pitchfork and his son. Had they handed it to me in person, there would be no need for that note. The conclusion was inescapable. They had written the post-it and put the CD-ROM in my jacket as I slept. So, children, please don't go to college and drink to the point of blacking out, even if you're in your 40s. If the worst thing that happens to you is some dude plants a mixtape on your person, that is violation enough. And to Professor Mark and the Pitchforks, I hope I have not hurt you with these revelations. I had a great time, and I am your friend. Nerve food. We were in our early 30s when we took on our house in rural western Massachusetts. We were grown-ups, but only theoretically. When you live in New York City, or any big city, it's easy to fail at growing up. The city is designed to keep you in a state of perpetual adolescence. You never need to learn to drive if you don't want to, and even if you do drive, you can go back to that bar you went to when you were 21, and it will still be there, and it will still be called Molly's, and the older waitress there will still remember you and let you sit wherever you want. And 5 years later, when she is no longer there, when there is just a picture of her above the bar in a place of sad honor, and you know what that means, and you don't want to think about it. Guess what? You don't have to, because no one is driving home, and you're back again listening to Fairy Tale of New York again, which is still on every jukebox, falling into the same conversations you had with the same friends in the 90s about how the internet is going to change culture and what you are going to do when you grow up. Or let's say later you move to Park Slope, Brooklyn in your mid-30s because you suddenly, impossibly, accidentally, have some money coming in from television, and you're able to actually buy an apartment. Impossible. And you think this is it. A mortgage, real estate taxes, a sleepy neighborhood full of strollers and unexciting restaurants. You have grown up. But it turns out, all of Brooklyn is suddenly alive with a not-growing-up renaissance. Suddenly you can walk for the first time to the newest bars to hear comedy and new music. You are surrounded by people younger than you, whose sense of style is to look like you. Young men growing dad beards and cultivating pallor and belly chub. You are struck by how much the young barista's glasses look just like the ones your mom used to wear, square and huge, overwhelming her face. And then double struck by how much Twin Peaks trivia this young barista seems to know. And you know that this is just fashion, that dressing like an old person is exactly what you used to do when you were a pretentious young person, too. But you bury that knowledge and enjoy the illusion. I am just like you. And even if you are lucky enough to own your own apartment, it's not a freestanding house. It's still just a glorified dorm room. If something fails or breaks or clogs, you don't need to fix it yourself. You call the building manager or superintendent or some other surrogate daddy to make it right. You don't need to shovel a driveway or clean a gutter. You certainly don't need to drive to the dump or know what a septic system is. I still don't know what a septic system is, and technically, I now own two of them. A few years ago, in rural western Massachusetts, a sound started coming out of the woods. It was a low, repeating, guttural sound, and it sounded like this. I will do it one more time. This sound went on, 24 hours a day, for 5 days, before finally one evening, as my wife and I sat on the deck bog-gazing, she turned to me and said, "What do you think that is?" And I said, probably a bird. It was not a bird. It was the sound of our septic pump failing. And I should have known something was going wrong, because in our basement, on the wall, is a box, and this box contains the septic control panel. And on top of the panel, there's a red dome light like you find on top of an old police car. And if things are going good for the septic system, light not on. But now the light had turned on, and had been on for days, revolving, filling my basement with the pulsing scarlet light of emergency. And it was not like I hadn't seen it. I had gone down there to the basement to use the dryer a few times. I knew that it probably indicated bad things for our septic system. And my solution was to stare at it. I would stare at the light for a minute or so, and then turn around and go back upstairs and try to forget it. My experience with computers had taught me to trust that a spinning red alert light is probably all just part of the process. If I turn it off and on again, or just leave it alone, it will probably fix itself. It did not fix itself, and so we had to call the septic daddy to come fix it. It was a very expensive lesson, but that does not mean that I learned it. Even now, my brain refuses to remember the explanation for what had happened, or what we did to solve it. It involved the relocation of the leach field, I think? But then I may only remember that because I enjoy the term leach field so much. And it really was our fault. We treated that septic system badly. The house came with a garbage disposal, which was exotic technology to us at the time. We had both had garbage disposals as kids, but when we moved to New York City, they exited our lives. You were not allowed to have a garbage disposal in Manhattan then. The sewer pipes were too delicate or something. But now, with a disposal of our very own, it seemed a direct link to the kind of easy suburban lifestyle we thought might never be ours. So it is fair to say we went a little disposal crazy. Our first summer there, my wife discovered a cache of old pantry items my mother had hoarded and left behind. Can after can of beans and soup and olives that were all now past their due date. "What is all this stuff?" my wife asked. I didn't know. It was upsetting to find. I don't know why my mother had bought all these cans of food never to open them. When you get a can of soup, the date printed on the bottom is a far distant future, impossible to reach. To hold a can of tomato soup now, 2 full years past that date, was like holding betrayal. "You were supposed to last forever," I wanted to tell that can of soup. My wife wanted to lay claim to this house and clear all this dead food out, so her plan was to dispose all every last bit of it. She started opening and grinding, cans of Stewart's shell beans and jars of old pickles and capers. It went on for hours. It was a hot Saturday summer afternoon. I sat at the kitchen table, watching her sweat and open and grind. It was probably the most erotic moment of our marriage. Eventually, she found her way to the back of the cupboard, and she dislodged three boxes of Cheerios. They were 5 years old. And she showed them to me. "What are you going to do with that, baby?" I said. "I'm going to dispose of all of this," she said. "That's fucking right you are," I said. And she did it. It was a terrible idea. Here is some homeowner's advice. Do not put even a single box of fresh Cheerios down the garbage disposal, never mind three old boxes. Because when you grind up Cheerios into oat powder and shove them into your pipes with a bunch of water behind them, the Cheerios do not slide easily through your pipes to the leach field. They absorb the water and they swell up. And then you have a Cheerio tumor in your pipes. And then you have to explain that Cheerio tumor to the plumber you have had to call to cut it out. He will stand in the basement with his hacksaw, tapping at the Cheerio metastasis, the pipe making a solid, grim thunk. And he will look at you and say, "How did this happen?" And you will have to say, "I'm sorry, Pipe Daddy. We were just having some sexy disposal time." Here is another bit of homeowner's advice. If you have never owned a freestanding house that is heated by propane, you may not know that the propane does not arrive by magic. This came as a great surprise to me. If you had asked me that first year we spent in rural western Massachusetts where the propane comes from, my guess would have been, tubes of some kind. And beyond that, who knew? I didn't know what that giant white metal Tylenol out in the backyard was for. I thought it was some weird personal submarine my dad had collected. But that is not what it is. That is a propane tank. And if you want it to be full of propane, you have to call the gas daddy. And if you don't call him, the gas daddy will not come. And that is when you arrive at your home in rural western Massachusetts in November. You will have a baby in your arms, and it will be late at night because you have had to stop twice along the way to feed that baby. Your house will be cold, and it will smell of garbage. And this will not be because of the five bags of rotting garbage you left in the garage last time you were here 2 months ago. No, the gas daddy will explain when he arrives that night to fill your tank. The propane itself is purposefully made to smell like rotting garbage. That way, if you have a gas leak, you will smell it. Or if you are running out of propane and it won't light anymore, you will smell the rotting garbage and call the gas daddy to get more. That smell is the propane's way of telling you that you have an emergency, he said. It smells like garbage because you are garbage. You are garbage people who do not deserve to own a home. We got better at it, but it took a while. Unlike the city, when you are surrounded on all sides by humanity's tributes to its own false triumphs over nature, condominiums and Whole Foods, for example, the structures you build in the country do not adequately protect you from all those things in the woods. The birds, yes, but also the ants and the mice will find their way in, and the wasps that will nest in your eaves and attack your baby for their own sick fun. Once a raccoon made a latrine of our porch. That means it shat all over it. Why mince words? A raccoon wouldn't. Raccoons are beyond fear, and they are assholes. I tried to chase a raccoon off our porch as it was casually emptying our bird feeder into its fat mouth. And as I yelled, it turned its head and eyed me with such casual contempt that I apologized to it. Once a raccoon used its little mutant human-like hands to open our screen door while we were just sitting there, gin and scrabbling. It poked its head into our human house and looked at us sadly as if to say, you guys know I could come in here and kill you at any time, right? I would soon learn that this raccoon was telling the truth. Because this time, when we left our house for several weeks, a raccoon saw our porch and said, this is all mine now, and just started pooping on it. And by the time we returned, the latrine was really developed, and I must confess, an admirable heap of feces, both fresh and dried. And I was about to sweep it all away when some reptilian survival impulse stopped me and sent me to Google. It turns out that many raccoons are infected with a parasitic roundworm called Balis ascaris procyonis, And by many, I mean it is estimated that some 72 to 100% of all raccoons have this worm inside them, and they are pooping out its eggs. And if you were to accidentally inhale such eggs, say by sending them into the air by sweeping a pile of old dry raccoon feces off your porch, they will hatch into larvae inside your body. In a few weeks, you may begin to experience increasingly serious symptoms, which the CDC lists with admirable comic deadpan as, quote, nausea, tiredness, liver enlargement, lack of coordination, lack of attention to people and surroundings, loss of muscle control, blindness, coma, end quote. That rather quick trip from nausea to coma is for grown-ups only, by the way. If you are a baby and you get infected, you could die. That is why raccoons and wasps are such good friends. They have shared interests in baby hate. The risk of infection is so serious that the CDC, a federal agency of the nanny state, goes on to suggest that the best way to deal with a raccoon latrine on your porch is to attack it with fire, to burn it and your own property with a propane torch. So, call your gas daddy for that extra propane. Nature is cruel, and it makes you cruel, too. It was in rural western Massachusetts that I confronted that cruelty and a profound moral paradox. I was caring for a beloved pet dwarf hamster during its end-of-life cycle. If you've ever had a pet dwarf hamster, then you know that its end-of-life cycle begins about 5 days after you buy it for your young son. And that is when it suddenly stops eating and starts becoming a hairless, half-filled hacky sack of wheezes and ragged bones that you are holding in your hand, hopelessly trying to force-feed it medicine from an eyedropper that was sold to you by a con man veterinarian for $500. And this is what I was doing in our kitchen in Massachusetts one evening, keeping one dwarf hamster alive, while at the same time, just on the other side of the kitchen door, in the dark of the garage, I was murdering dozens of field mice a week with traps and poison. Now, field mice are the exact same size as dwarf hamsters. They are somewhat more dusky in color and somewhat more likely to sneak in through the garage and live in the walls and hide caches of seeds underneath your pillows if you are not around for a few weeks. But otherwise, they are the same animal. The only difference is that this rodent, the one dying in my hand, is the one we chose to dignify with a name, Flurry. This is the one we decided arbitrarily had value and deserved love. And by value, I think $13.99, something like that. Even Flurry knew this was bogus. There she was in my hand, waving off the eyedropper of medicine with her withered paw as if to say, stop this. This is some insane cognitive dissonance. Please just let me die. And I said, no, Flurry, I'm not giving up on you. You are going to make it. Now you just rest quietly here for a moment while I go out to the garage to see how many of your brother's heads I've smashed in today. Because that is the humane way to kill mice that are invading your home. You quickly smash in their heads with a snap trap, rather than snaring them in a glue trap so they can slowly starve to death. Well, yes, you can catch them in a humane trap and then return them to nature, where, having lived warmly in your walls for their whole lives, they can now revel freely in an exposed ditch somewhere until they are eaten by a hawk. That would be the humane thing to do. Nature is the meanest trap of all. Every week I would go out into the garage and collect the bodies of the mice crushed in the spent traps and throw them away. It never got easy. When you humanely crush a mouse's head in, their eyes bulge like dark blackberries full of shock and confusion. Their eyes seem to ask, what just happened? Why did it happen? And why did it happen to me and not Flurry? I had no good answer as to why Flurry deserved to live instead of the mouse. Well, I mean, it's true that Flurry knew the term cognitive dissonance. That's pretty impressive for a dwarf hamster. But what it really came down to was that the dead creature in my hand literally was a country mouse, and Flurry was a city mouse. Tribalism is poisonous but powerful, and I sided with the coastal elite. Oh, but also, I would say to those sad and lifeless mouse eyes. Flurry never pooped 100 times in my silverware drawer last night. So, goodbye and good riddance, my eternal enemy. And then I would throw the mouse body away and let it decay there in the garbage bag for months and months, unmourned. Of course, we were punishing the mice to punish ourselves. And we had lived with that mouse poop for a long time before we took action. For years, we would come back to the house and open the drawers and once again see those little ice cream sprinkles of mouse droppings in there and just say, oh, well. We took out the silverware and we washed the drawer. And then eventually, we surrendered to the mice. We left the drawer empty for them. We kept all the forks and knives and spoons and upright glasses on the counter. When Jonathan and Christine would come to visit, we would say, don't open those drawers because they're full of mouse poop. And they wouldn't. And they thought that was a fine way to live. It amazes me that they would ever come back to our house. Well, let's call it what it was, our shit house, ever again after that. But they did, because they were as young and as dumb as we were. None of us had children at that time, so the full feces immersion therapy that is caring for infants had not yet begun. If something seemed troublesome or gross in our lives, we would close the metaphoric drawer and just walk away. So what was it that flipped the switch in our maturing brains to appropriate revulsion? I don't remember. One day I looked into the poop drawer, and the patterns the droppings made were like tea leaves, but this time telling me a new and different story. Right, I remember thinking. It is not okay to live this way. Grown-ups do not let mice poop in the drawer. Grown-ups do not let raccoons poop on their porch. The definition of a grown-up is that they deal with shit. That's almost all they do. They get shit done. And that's when the traps came out. We grew up in that house. But we didn't grow up too much. We didn't have to. For as I have mentioned, the region is full of young people, and it's also been peculiarly attractive to rock musicians from the 1990s. For a while, indie guitarists and lead singers homesteaded in and around Northampton, a small city and former home to Calvin Coolidge. I don't know what drew them there. Perhaps it was Northampton's very charming and passable imitation of a big city, with three-story brick buildings sheltering good coffee shops and record stores and theaters and concert venues and a cool radio station. Northampton has long-standing overlapping communities of activists, lesbians, artists, writers, and glass blowers. One of my great regrets is missing the chance to meet Leonard Nimoy when he was in town for a reception at the Northampton Art Gallery that routinely deals in his beautiful photographs of nude people. You don't get failed chance encounters with Nimoy and nudes in a whole lot of rural America. So maybe that's why rock musicians picked this spot to do their own growing up and kid-having in peace and quiet. Whatever the case, I won't violate their privacy by naming them here. Except for one. I met Black Francis near the petting zoo at a county fair. If you do not know, Black Francis is the lead singer of a band called the Pixies. I had actually met him very briefly a few years before because his wife, Violet Clark, had asked me to sign one of my books for her oldest son, who was then one of those strange and luminous 13-year-olds who are my key demo. But the Heath Fair was the first time I spent any real time with them and their family. When they moved to Western Massachusetts, I ran into them at a cafe, and we arranged to meet at the fair. It was a weird, middle-aged, full-family first date. And that's how I found myself, by the goat pen at the petting zoo, sitting down at a picnic table, making small talk with one of my cultural heroes. Black Francis was talking about going back on tour. I was trying not to talk about how important his work and his voice had been to me, how the pure jangle scream of the Pixies late in high school shocked me into a new mode of being, one where I was more tolerant of risk and adventure and less inclined to listen to the mannered jump jive of Joe Jackson. Sorry, Joe Jackson. But I couldn't actually say these things out loud to Black Francis, who had introduced himself by his given name, Charles. I think instead I spoke about the goats. I said they were good at jumping on top of those little barrels. I would not say that Black Francis and I initially clicked. He's a very decent and slyly funny person, but he was reticent. I suspect decades' worth of conversations with dudes who are pretending not to freak out about the fact that they are talking to Black Francis will make you a little reticent. But I could and did joke and gossip easily with Violet, who's also a very smart and talented musician, but not someone I grew up with inside my head. And so I invited them back to dinner, and they said yes. This is the dinner with Black Francis that I alluded to in the previous chapter. See? I'm not a liar. The mouse poop stage of our lives was over at this point. There was nothing to be ashamed of in our drawers. I made vegan pizza for Violet's vegan son, and I talked to him about science fiction. The younger kids did their best to socialize. My own son suggested that he break the ice by blasting the vinyl copy of the Pixies' Doolittle that I had given him earlier as a primer on the subject of who was coming to dinner. Luckily, I intercepted him just as he was about to drop the needle. Violet and my wife were chatting at the table that had belonged to my grandmother, and Black Francis was mostly quiet until he opened the refrigerator to find dozens of cans of Diet Moxie. His face opened in a smile. He said, "I haven't had Moxie for years." Moxie, if you don't know, is a very old regional soft drink native to New England. It was once known as Moxie Nerve Food, as its history goes back to the time when soda was patent medicine. Coca-Cola was served at the drugstore because it was a palatable delivery system for a healthy, natural stimulant called cocaine. Predating Coke, Moxie's own medicinal cred derived from a bitter slap of gentian root, giving a flavor profile somewhere between Dr. Pepper and witch hazel. It is difficult to enjoy, even ironically, and so it has largely stayed within the confines of Massachusetts and Maine, where it is sometimes mixed with coffee brandy, as the people of Maine have a punishing streak of self-hatred that makes Bostonians seem like light-hearted imps. I was explaining all this to Black Francis, as my wife shrugged. She's heard it all before. But I didn't need to explain it to him because he is from Boston and knew most of it already, and for the rest of the evening, Black Francis depleted my Moxie cash can by can. And the medicine did its work. We didn't talk much more that night, but here was a line of connection, and for me a chance at some small repayment of an enormous debt. I have rarely been as happy. I could pay this cultural debt to Black Francis and many other actual money debts, in part because I had just made a bunch of money. Now, obviously my life has always been privileged. My grandparents worked hard to foist their children up a rung on the class ladder. But also we benefited from a nation's lifetime of policies, de jure and de facto, to help people who looked like us get along. And I took all of this for granted. I stood lazily on all of these shoulders and got so lazy I had forgotten to make any money of my own. I wrote for magazines and websites and I was paid mostly in small checks and journalist swag. But you can't support even a small family in Manhattan with a designer's chef knife, some mail-order beef jerky and a thorn-proof wax cotton jacket, or the fond memories of a junket to a Caribbean island where a man shot fine tequila into my mouth from a super soaker. I don't remember how high my credit card debt got as I continued to ignore this fact. Many tens of thousands of dollars. I became adept at averting my eyes from the total in shame as I paid the minimum month after month. Credit card companies loved me. What my grandparents had done for my parents and what my parents had done for me, I would be unable to do for my own children, which is to say provide. Now at the end of the long list of squandered advantages was this house in Massachusetts, my mother's house, which on many panicky 3 a.m. awakenings, I would frequently fantasize about liquidating for cash. But then I wrote a book, and then I went on television. And then I had money. Real, grown-up money. That sentence is as swift and as dumbly easy as it all felt, and when it happened, all of those problems and all of that shame went away instantly. This country is founded on some very noble ideals, but also some very big lies, and one of those lies is that everyone has a fair chance at success. Another is that rich people have to be smart and hardworking, or else they wouldn't be rich. Another is that if you're not rich, don't worry about it, because rich people aren't really happy. I am the white, male, living proof that all of that is garbage. The vast degree to which my mental health improved, once I had the smallest measure of economic security, immediately unmasked this shameful fiction to me. Money cannot buy happiness, but it buys the conditions for happiness. Time, occasional freedom from constant worry, a moment of breath to plan for the future, and the ability to be generous. The motto of Massachusetts calls it a quiet peace under liberty. To be in your own space, a space that is clean and free from mouse poop, and to have enough to share, to give vegan cheese and medicinal soft drinks to the people who have made your life better. That is the best version of being a grown-up. And I won't be shy about bragging about that night, or for violating Black Francis's privacy in the telling, because it made me appreciate how few get to enjoy this calm security, and what a crime that is. I'm sorry, Charles and Violet. I enjoyed running into you both again when I performed at the Shea Theater in Montague, Massachusetts last fall. I hope you are still enjoying rural Western Massachusetts. I'm sorry we hardly ever go there anymore. This is The Middle. Graveyard Fun. When my daughter was younger, we would sometimes go to the cemetery. The cemetery is called Greenwood Cemetery. It's in Brooklyn, and its main entrance is on 24th Street, where a giant Gothic triple-spired gate presides. A colony of green monk parakeets, supposedly descendants of a long-ago pet store jailbreak, nest and chatter there among its cold, stony hollows. They liven up the cemetery, because parakeets are famous for their irony. But there is a side gate, nearer to where we live, that my daughter and I stumbled across one spring. It was just there at the end of Prospect Park West, hiding in plain sight after the last block of shops and houses and schools, like a purloined letter. I was excited when we found it. I already loved our neighborhood, but to discover, after years of living there, that it also had a secret door to a massive Edward Gorey-esque necropolis was dreamlike, an embarrassment of weird riches. "Never forget what your father and mother have given you," I said to my daughter. "Let's go in." At that time, I only had a mustache. It was a rainy, humid, gray spring day, and I was wearing a raincoat with my hood up and dark sunglasses for some reason. My daughter was wearing her red rain jacket and yellow boots. And we approached the guard at the gate, and he stopped us. "Are you sure you want to go into the cemetery?" he said. "Oh, yes," I said. "I was not talking to you," he said. "I was talking to her." And then he looked at my daughter and said, "The cemetery is very large. There are many places you can go where no one could hear you if you needed help, even if there were a lot of visitors today, which there are not, because of the rain. So I ask again, are you sure you want to go into this cemetery, alone, with this man who has a mustache and is wearing dark glasses?" "I am not afraid," said my daughter, "for this is my father." Reluctantly, the guard accepted this truth and let us pass. The guard was correct. The cemetery was mostly empty, above ground at least. But below, it was full to bursting. They don't bury many bodies anymore. They're almost out of room. So the ground was heaving with the dead, and nature feasted on it. We wandered over mounds of the greenest grass, and the limbs of the dogwoods, heavy with rain and fresh blooms, dipped to meet us as we navigated around the headstones and obelisks and peered through gated windows into dark tombs. It was vivid and beautiful and quiet and not scary. In fact, I realized, we were the scariest things in the cemetery. There were a few actual mourners, but they had the sense to drive through the cemetery rather than plod through the rain and the muck, and we ran into these mourners from time to time on the road. Coming around a bend, we would see their headlights, and we would wave our hands in greeting. And each time, the car would slow to a stop, I couldn't see into their windows. I couldn't see their faces, but I could imagine their inner debate as they paused. Should we get out and save that little girl from that man? Or should we flee from those obvious terrifying ghosts who are creepily waving at us, trying to lure us out of our car so they can steal our souls forever? After a while, one impulse would win out over the other, and they would drive on. This happened several times. It was fantastic. I said to my daughter, "Let's come back here every weekend. We will stand by the side of the road and wave at passing cars in unison. And as they turn the road, we will run over the hill to end run them and wave at them a second time like the phantom hitchhiker from the Twilight Zone. We will freak them out. Look at us. We have all the odd and specific details that make a good ghost story. People will say, 'I went to the cemetery and saw them. The pale girl in the red raincoat and the mustache man who killed her.' They will tell the story to their friends. And soon enough, people will come looking for us. They may even imagine they've seen us even on those days when we don't come. They may even imagine that they see us when you're in college, and I am too sad to come here by myself. And so our journey through this underworld will become legend, and we will continue, like descendants of the birds. And that way, I told my daughter, we will live forever." Part 2. Maine Humor. I said we hardly ever go to Massachusetts anymore, and that is true, because we have been spending more time in Maine. My wife grew up going there every summer. Her grandmother had visited there for many years, and when her husband died, she moved there permanently. My wife's grandmother bought a house in 1974 on a narrow peninsula that dangles south into a bay near Mount Desert Island. The sun touches Maine first among every state in the Union, but Maine likes to confuse people and generally feels conflicted on the subject of light and warmth. So its shattered coastline of necks and points and isles hides from the sun, facing any direction but east. The house my wife's grandmother bought was full of antique furniture and included a wide swath of land from one shore of the peninsula to the other, all costing something like $100 and a sack of shells. After many years, my wife's grandmother died. Her middle son lives in that house now year-round. He's a retired chemist and now full-time wood splitter and family lore keeper. Her youngest son is a semi-retired boat and house builder. He built his own house and workshop with his own hands in a nearby town, and he has lived year-round in Maine all his adult life. Her oldest son, my father-in-law, became a professor of English in Atlanta. But he is retired now, too, and lives half the year with my wife's stepmother in his own home by an interior, brooding, private lake that suits their mood. The crags of Maine's landscape and culture offer few easy handholds. Altogether, my wife's family has been holding fast to both for half a century. None of them would be considered Mainers. They are still from away. Maine used to be part of Massachusetts by some arrangement that made zero sense. They have never shared a border. And for most of the early life of the Union, Massachusetts ignored Maine, which was named for either a French province or a British town, or the fact that the dirt and rock portions of the state are not oceans, but the mainland. Nobody knows for sure. Large parts of the region north of the Penobscot River were barely mapped and essentially ceded to British Canada. It only became a state in 1820 as part of the Missouri Compromise. Missouri wanted to enter the Union as a state, and the U.S. government was like, "Great, we are trying to get to 50 of them, come on in." But Missouri wanted to enter as a slave state, so the U.S. government needed to find a new territory to enter as a free state, because it was believed that this would make the practice of owning other humans less brutally and eternally criminal somehow. Guess what? It didn't. All the same, the government started calling around to the states and commonwealths, asking if anyone had any garbage land they didn't want, and Massachusetts is like, "Oh yes, absolutely we do. We have this huge, massive hump of half Canada up there that we never use. Go ahead and take it." And that was how Maine was born, a new state, created in part to sustain a horrible evil but only serving to delay its inevitable collapse by 43 years, one further generation of legal slavery. Well, among white people, considering the lifespan among slaves themselves, more like two generations. To be fair, the humans of Maine did not seek this legacy. They simply disliked Massachusetts and wanted to be alone.